King Rurava inaugurated a Karmakanda sacrifice. Thus, Pururava, who considered the Jagfire his son, was able to go to Gandharvaloka as he desired. Purport. In such a yuga, Lord Narayan was worshipped by meditation, Kriteyad Yayato Vishnu. Indeed, everyone always meditated upon Lord Vishnu Narayan and achieved every success by this process of meditation. In the next yuga, Treta Yuga, the performance of Jagya began. Tretayam Yajato Mukai. Therefore, this verse says, Trayi Treta Mukai. Ritualistic ceremonies are generally called fruitive activities. Srila Vishvanatha Chakravarti Thakur says that in the Treta Yuga, beginning with the Swayambhuva Manvantara, ritualistic fruitive activities were similarly manifested from Priyavrata, etc. Thus ends the Bhakti purports of the 9th canto, 14th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled King Rurava Enchanted by Urvasi. Om Gyanatvarandisha Gyananjana Slakri Shakshuni Tamina Tasmai Sri Rivayana Mahana. Vanchikalpa Trubhischa Kripa Sindhu Vivicha Patitano Pavanebhyo Vaishi Vibhyo Namo Namaha. Well, I believe it's certainly with mixed feelings that we bid adieu to King Pururava. I think very, very interesting chapter, kind of a fascinating chapter, Srimad Bhagavatam. Many, many different points were covered in this chapter. And we certainly learned a lot about the activities of the demigods and some of the great kings of this time, and some very, very instructive lessons. And of course, one of the most instructive lessons from the story of King Pururava has to do with the entanglement of the living entity because of sexual desire. So I think we've learned that one very thoroughly from this very long narration of King Pururava and his great attachment to Urvasi. But it's interesting that as we come to the end of it, King Pururava actually performs a sacrifice. Even though his idea or his goal was to be able to go to the Gandharvaloka planet and become reunited with Urvasi, it's described a couple of verses ago that he did this by sacrifice to Vishnu, to the Supreme Personality of God, Hari. So he may have had some material desire, and he certainly had some material desire. He did the right thing. Because we know that whatever one's material desire is, whether one has all material desires, no desires, or desires liberation, one should worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So he did that. He had material desire, but he fulfilled or attempted to fulfill those desires by worshiping the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And he did so by the practice of jagya, performance urge sacrifices. It's described here, apparently, that we are moving from the Satya Yuga into the Treta Yuga, right at this time that's being described in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So in Friday's verse, a description of Satya Yuga was given. And now we have gone from Satya Yuga to Treta Yuga, and it's described that that King Pururava understood this within his heart. Again, evidence that he's quite an elevated. Shesha Prabhu was giving the case for King Pururava the other day, a few days ago, and explained that in many ways, although we see these material attachments, we also see many signs of greatness, many signs that he is a great devotee and an exalted personality. So somehow within his heart, he understood that Satya Yuga had passed, now it is Treta Yuga, so now it is not proper for performing meditation, but now is the time for performing sacrifice, and he did so. So we understand, of course, many, many times throughout our literatures, we have descriptions of the cyclical nature of the material universe, and we understand that in every day of Lord Brahma, there is 1,000 of these called Mahayugas or Divya Yugas, the cycle of four yugas. Each one of these cycles lasts 4,320,000 years, and we go through the four yugas of Satya, Treta, Dwapara, and Kali, and it's described that the length of them is Satya Yuga is 4/10, then 3/10, then 2/10, then 1/10. So that's why Kali Yuga is 432,000 years, 1/10 of the entire time. The actual figures, which you probably all were wanting to know, is Satya Yuga is 1,800,000 years, Treta 1,200,000, Dwapara 800,000, Kali Yuga 432,000. So as this is occurring, we also have a progressive deterioration of human society as the yugas are going from Satyajitra to Dwarapartha Kali. So one of the symptoms of this deterioration is lifespan. In Satyayuga, the average lifespan was 100,000 years. Treta, it was 10,000. Dwapar, 1,000. And Kali Yuga, as Prabhupada says, barely 100 years. In fact, 100 years is rather unusual. I noticed in the newspaper that in the Gainesville paper a week or two ago, that some lady passed away who was 112 years old. And they said that she was something like the 20th or 21st oldest person on the planet, they calculated. I don't know how they know everybody's ages on the planet. But at any rate, she was quite old, was the idea. She was in, you know, one of the oldest, very, very oldest people around. So, in other words, reaching 100 years of age is actually very rare. And as we go through Kali Yuga, and one of the verses in the 12th canto of the Bhagavatam says the age will be 50. And then other places that it's mentioned that by the end of Kali Yuga, more like 30 years old. I think Prabhupada said 30 years old would be considered a ripe old age by the very, very end of the Kali Yuga. So this deterioration is going on steadily. And because there is some deterioration, but there is always devotees of the Lord. And even though the qualities of the people is declining, there are always those who are worshiping the Lord, and thus there are different performances of activities of worship of Krishna that are appropriate for those different ages. So in today's purport, Srila Prabhupada is quoting this verse. He mentions two different lines of it. That verse is from the Srimad Bhagavatam 12.352. And the full verse is Kriteya Dayato Vishnam Tretayam Yajito Makai Dwapare Paracharyayam Kalu Tadhari Kirtanat. Whatever result was obtained in Satya Yuga by meditating on Vishnu, in Treta Yuga by performing sacrifice, and in Dwarpa Yuga by performing by serving the Lord's lotus feet, can be obtained in Kali Yuga simply by the chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. So we see that progressively, the process has become perhaps a little bit easier. The process of meditation in Satyayuga was very difficult because it took so long. You had to have a lifespan of 100,000 years. How long did Vishwamitramuni meditate? Was it 60,000 years? Is that right? Yeah, it was something like that. But anyway, very, very long periods of time were required for this meditation. In trying to perform the very complicated yoga system, very, very difficult. And one had to have very, very fixed mind, very strong intelligence. And all of these things, of course, are missing. In Treta Yuga, still fairly elevated age, still we see kings like Garuda, Priyavrata is mentioned, and we see so many others. We read about Ashwamedha sacrifices and so many of these ritualistic sacrifices that were performed. But who normally performed them? Often they were the kings and emperors. And there's a reason for that. Because they took incredible amounts of resources, you know, gold and, you know, when we say ghee, we say, well, ghee's not very available. We think, well, we can make ghee. Well, they probably had to have like thousands of gallons of ghee and, you know, so many things. They had to have gold. They, you know, give away thousands of cows. And it was on a much more opulent and grand scale than we can imagine. When we think of a fire sacrifice, you know, we think of what we do and we get a little pit and we put some sticks in and, you know, and it's very nice. It's very nice because the bhakti is there, the devotion is there, and it serves the purpose. But it's nothing like I can only imagine what the sacrifice that Pururva did. I mean, it was probably this incredible, gigantic affair that we could barely imagine what to speak of actually perform. So that became less and less possible. Then, of course, in Dwapara Yuga, we had worship of the deity. Now, of course, we still worship the deity. But again, we can imagine what a grand scale that was probably done at. And even that becomes more and more difficult for people to become completely purified. Because for one thing, proper worship of the deity requires very, very exalted Brahmins. Now, what is the symptom of Kali Yuga? Kalu Sudra Sambhava. Basically, we're all Shudras. Very, very few qualified Brahmins. That's one of the symptoms we'll read about in a minute of Kali Yuga. Very few qualified Brahmins to perform proper worship. So, of course, we do our best. You know, Prabhupada said we are Prabhupada made us Brahmins with the idea that we are trying to become qualified. It's kind of like our preliminary, yes, we're a Brahmin, but now we're really trying to work to actually be a Brahmin, you know, which is not quite so easy. So because of the potential for offenses and not having highly qualified people, even deity worship in itself, if that were our only practice, we probably would not be successful. Now, one thing that's interesting is when the different aparads are mentioned, one of the aparads is seva aparad, or, you know, when we make offenses in our worship of the deity. So how do we counteract what's mentioned in the scriptures? How do we counteract seva aparad? Chanting Hare Krishna? Absolutely. It's actually described by Rupa Goswami that most seva aparad will be burned up through the chanting of the holy name. Now, of course, then we get into the other type of offenses against the holy name. That's where we have a problem. They're not quite so easily solved. But most seva aparad, which is inadvertent, in other words, we go on the altar, we're very sincere, we're trying our best, we want to worship the Lord, you know, and we drop a piece of paraphernalia because that's our nature. All right, you know, if we chant Hare Krishna, beg for the Lord's forgiveness, we're forgiven. It's not that we're going to go to hell for making an inadvertent mistake. Not that it should be purpose or deliberate. We should always, of course, try to give our absolute best worship. But if there is some inadvertent mistake or offense to the deity, the process of chanting Hare Krishna will usually clear that up. So we have to have this chanting of the holy name. So that's absolutely necessary in this Kali Yuga because we have so little resources, so many good qualities, which may have been possible in the other ages. And it's described here that the same result is obtained by the chanting of Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. In fact, it says, my dear king, this is at 12.351, although Kali Yuga is an ocean of faults, there is still one good quality about this age. Simply by chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, one can become free from material bondage and be promoted to the transcendental kingdom. So we have many similar verses throughout the Srimad Bhagavatam, and Srila Prabhupada spoke about this so many times, of how the same result of all other types of spiritual practices, meditation, any yoga system, will all be attained through the chanting of the holy name. Not only is the chanting of the holy name particularly powerful in itself, and the chanting of the holy name, it's not that in other yugas people didn't chant Hare Krishna or chant the holy names of the Lord. The glorification of chanting the holy name is always there. Devotees are always doing that. But in Kali Yuga, it's particularly powerful. It's particularly potent because Krishna has arranged it that way, that this is the process for self-realization in Kali Yuga. I wanted to take a moment and go back to the Bhagavatam, the 12th canto, 2nd chapter, verses 1 through 7, where the symptoms of Kali Yuga are described. And it's I found this very interesting reading this and meditating upon this, because we often hear that people are very short-lived, or we're not able to, we have so many poor qualities and things like this. But it's an interesting description, because although we're only 5,000 years into Kali Yuga, you can see many of these things have already manifested. This is written 5,000 years ago, and it's almost a quick prediction of what we see today. So I'll read through this a little bit. Shukadeva Goswami said, then, O king, religion, truthfulness, cleanliness, tolerance, mercy, duration of life, physical strength and memory will all diminish day by day because of the powerful influence of the age of Kali. In Kali Yuga, wealth alone will be considered the sign of a man's good birth, proper behavior and fine qualities, and law and justice will be applied only on the basis of one's power. So, I mean, this is something we definitely see, that those who are wealthy, anybody with money is greatly glorified. They become, the people that are considered these prominent people, the Bill Gates and the Buffett, and all of these people, they're the ones who are glorified. They are the epitome. This is what people should attain to. In other words, having wealth is considered to be the greatest virtue in Kali Yuga. It's also interesting, law and justice is only applied on the basis of one's power. And of course, wealth also translates to power often, particularly in this age. And we can see that in so many cases, that it seems as though that if you have power and if you have wealth, then the justice system is a little more available to you, O.J. Simpson. We can think of so many different situations. And also, I think, in terms of our leaders, how do you become an elected leader in a democracy? Well, you know, you can be very virtuous and you can have great ideas and you can sit up there and you can appeal on the basis of character, morality, and conscience, you know, and appeal to the voters, and are they going to all vote for you? Well, maybe, but more than likely, if you have a very well-funded campaign, they call it their war chest that they have to create, and often before a person is nominated, I don't really follow politics a lot, I used to more, but for instance, if you go into the primaries where the party is going to select their candidate, their ability to raise funds is one of the primary considerations. Actually, I did just a little quick research this morning and, you know, found some different things. There's a lot of studies done on this. Is the correlation between how much money is spent in a campaign and whether you win. It's very obvious. You spend, you know, why do they all raise so much money? Why do they do so much advertising? Why do they do this? Because they know their chances of winning are better. The more they just put their name in front of people. It's nothing to do with their qualities, their character, their ideas, even their managerial ability to lead the people. You know, it's simply a matter of getting your name out there and, of course, destroying the reputation of your opponent. You know, and that's one thing that we've noticed. I've seen this over the years. They talk more and more and more about how campaigns become so dirty and it's all this mudslinging. And just it becomes a matter of just find something to discredit the opponent, to destroy their reputation. And, of course, just try to keep your own reputation as clean as possible. Anyway, one study I saw showed I was a former statistics professor, but a 0.84 correlation, which is pretty high, between spending and winning elections. So in other words, it's not absolutely guaranteed, but you have a very, very good chance of getting in power if you have enough money. So this is a Kali Yuga symptom. It's not by quality, it's not by character, it's not by the abilities people have, but rather their ability to put together wealth and power and be able to gain position. And then once one is in that position, then one has unlimited ability to basically run things the way that they want. We'll go on. Men and women will live together merely because of superficial attraction, and success in business will depend on deceit. Womanliness and manliness will be judged according to one's expertise in sex, and a man will be known as a Brahmin just by wearing a thread. I mean, we certainly see this now, particularly, you know, we see often in India that, in other words, someone is a Brahmin simply by being born in a Brahmin family and wearing a thread, but it doesn't have to do with guna and karma. As the Bhagavad Gita says, that one's varna and ashram are about one's qualities of work, not by one's birth. Anyway, that's going on. We see that the whole Brahminical society is broken down like this. It says, a person's spiritual position will be ascertained merely according to external symbols. In the same basis, people will change from one spiritual order to the next. So I think this is referring to people may take sannyas, not take sannyas, change all their ashrams back and forth, kind of depending upon whim. A person's propriety will be seriously questioned if he does not earn a good living. And one who is very clever at juggling words will be considered a learned scholar. These aren't just, you know, this is not hyperbole. This isn't just that the, you know, Bhagavatam is, you know, sort of throwing out something that is, you know, exaggerated. It's not. This is very, very true. As many of you know, I've had some experience in the academic world, being a professor and administrator of universities, and this word juggling is really so prominent. If someone writes a research article, the next thing that happens is that all the other professors try to tear it apart, you know, and try to, you know, in this back and forth and this, you know, kind of, it's not a question of looking for the absolute truth or even some relative truth in the material world or arriving at what is actually correct. It's more a question of juggling words, trying to develop new theories, new ideas, try to contradict the other person's theory and ideas and put forth your own. So, and there's absolutely no consideration of hearing from higher authority. Maybe it is a little bit. You have to pay your dues when you're a student. When you're a student, you have to, observe the propriety of your, paying your dues to your professors. But once you get past that, once you're through, then you know then there's no sense of respect for any higher authority or higher knowledge. You know, everyone is on their own, and everyone's idea is just as good as another's idea, depending upon how strongly you can put it forward and how much you can convince others of your idea. A person will be judged unholy if he does not have money, and hypocrisy will be accepted as virtue. Marriage will be arranged simply by verbal agreement, and a person will think he is fit to appear in public if he has merely taken a bath. Well, we see a lot of people don't even take a bath and think that they're fit to be in public now. I'm going to go back to this thing about men and women a little bit, because I thought this was a very interesting part. A sacred place will be taken to consist of no more than a reservoir of water located at a distance, and beauty will be thought to depend upon one's hairstyle. And we can see that all you have to do is look at all the magazines, you know, along the in the grocery stores and the racks there. You know, it's like half of them are about what kind of hairstyle it has, you know, to make yourself very beautiful. I thought it was always interesting. Of course, you know, it's not so much today, but, you know, many, many years ago when some of us joined the Hare Krishna movement, there was two hairstyles. You know, there was one for men, which is you shaved your head with a sikh, and there was one for women where you, whatever you do, braid it, you know, in the back. And that was it. You know, there was no other hairstyle. It was very, very simple. You know, anyway, think, well, why is that? You know, because it helps us to remember we're not our body. It helps us to de-emphasize the beautification, the glorification of the body, trying to make it look so nice. Because what's that about? That's about attracting the other sex. So if we live very simply, you know, have very simple, you know, we had also one style of clothes, you know, it's pretty, never good, you know, dhotis and saris never go out of fashion. Although I understand it's probably what's the latest, you know, whatever. I mean, I know there's fashion involved to some degree, but on the other degree, it's pretty simple. I mean, people have been wearing, you know, what we call devotional attire for thousands of years, you know, and it's always in fashion. You know, so life is very simple, and it takes away from this competitiveness of trying to beautify oneself continually more and more to attract the opposite sex. Okay, he who can maintain a family will be regarded as an expert man. It's actually true. I mean, it's actually very difficult in Kali Yuga just to maintain a family. Anyone who's especially devotee householders know that it's like just trying to make a living sometimes is such a challenge. You know, it's kind of like when they say at somebody's funeral, they say, well, I can't think of too much good about the guy. They say, well, at least Joe was a good provider. You know, and that's actually a great virtue in Kali Yuga. Just to be able to support your family is difficult. And so a person is considered expert if they're even able to do that. You know. As the earth thus became crowded with a corrupt population, whoever among the social classes shows himself to be the strongest will gain political power. So I'm going to go back and just pull out some of those things about men and women, since this whole chapter has been about this topic. It says, men and women will live together merely because of superficial attraction. It says, womanliness and manliness will be judged according to one's expertise in sex. And then it says, marriage will be arranged simply by verbal agreement. So the theme here is that in former times, when there was more adherence to religious principles, marriage was almost a sacred, we could say, yes, it was a sacred institution because it was ordained by Krishna according to laws of religious, according to religious principle, and it had a higher purpose. The purpose of marriage was a way to work and to serve in this material world for a man and a woman to come together in devotional service, you know, to be able to raise a family, a God-conscious family, to raise children who would become Krishna-conscious, and actually to help one another. For those who were not ready to be celibate or were not at that situation in life, and obviously you can't have a society of everybody's celibate anyway, you have to have somebody who is, producing children, but also producing the wealth of society. Of the four ashrams, grihasthas really create wealth. The brahmacharis, the vanaprasas, and sannyasis are not supposed to. They're not working, making money. So only the grihastha ashram is really the one who's supposed to be working and supporting the other ashrams. Because now, as we can see, householders can barely support themselves, what to speak of support the other ashrams. You know, but there was a great purpose in marriage, and it was connected with Krishna consciousness. It was connected with spiritual life, and it was connected with varnashram dharma, of the progressive movement of society towards increase God consciousness of the entire population. And now we're seeing these very symptoms of Kali Yuga, which work directly against that. It's interesting. It says a marriage will be arranged simply by verbal agreement. Isn't this absolutely true now? I used to know these statistics better, but I think it's very close, if not the majority, of people do not even get married. There's more people probably just cohabitating, living together, than actually even becoming married. And then, how long do those marriages last? Half the marriages end in divorce. And so this whole idea that that one makes a commitment, you know, that there is a greater purpose, is completely gone. And it becomes completely arbitrary, completely whimsical. It says that a value is really all based upon sex life, and that one just simply makes a verbal agreement. Let's do this for a while, and if it doesn't work out, if we don't like it, if I'm not happy, then I find somebody else. So that is a symptom of Kali Yuga written about 5,000 years ago, which seems to be completely in place by now. So I can't even imagine as Kali Yuga degrades, as we go along in time, I mean, we're really basically, it'll totally descend into complete animal life. I mean, it's halfway there now, you know, and this is the direction that it's headed. You know, so Prabhupada would so often say, what's the point? What is the point? The point is to get out. don't stay around. Kali Yuga is not going to get better. It's going to get worse. Of course, we're in this golden age of Kali right now because of the influence of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So it's like we have these two countervailing things going on at the same time. We have, you know, the golden age of Kali, where the Sankirtan movement is growing, expanding, and many, many people are coming to Krishna consciousness. At the same time, we can see materially everything is degrading. You know, so that may go on, both simultaneously. And so we shouldn't be surprised if there is more and more material difficulties. But at the same time, there will be more and more spiritual opportunities, at least in this period of time, until Kali Yuga takes full force. So, as we said, the process for this age of Kali is the chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. This is our process of becoming relieved from all the distresses of Kali Yuga. This is our process of self-realization. So, the process of chanting Hare Krishna helps us to control the mind. Another symptom of Kali Yuga is that there is great mental disturbance. People are always agitated, they're always disturbed. This is mentioned, this is said in the Bhagavatam, and this is something that is self-evident. We see this everywhere. People are disturbed, people are in anxiety, people are in stress all the time. So the only way that the mind can become calm, the mind can become peaceful, is through chanting Hare Krishna. In the Path of Perfection, Srila Prabhupada said, by chanting Hare Krishna, one captures the mind immediately. Just by saying the name Krishna and hearing it, the mind is automatically fixed on Krishna. This means that the yoga system is immediately attained. In this part, he was talking about the different types of yoga and going back to the idea of the progression through the different yugas, how it's very difficult to meditate or very difficult to perform Ashtanga yoga or any of these other practices today. But yet, again, the mind, in the same way that could be controlled through this process of meditation, can equally be controlled by the process of chanting Hare Krishna. Prabhupada says the mind is automatically fixed on Krishna. And why is that? Because the name Krishna and Krishna are non-different. Krishna is his name. Krishna is within his name. Krishna is non-different. So when we associate with the holy name, we are associating directly with Krishna, and therefore the mind becomes fixed. And, of course, the word mantra means to deliver the mind. This is our process. And this is our difficulty. This is our problem in Kali Yuga, that the mind is, causes us so much difficulty. And, in fact, even at the very beginning of Kali Yuga, which was, of course, the Battle of Kurukshetra, was right on that cusp between the Dwapara and Kali Yuga. And, of course, Kali Yuga began when Lord Krishna disappeared from this earth. Knowing that, Krishna spoke to Arjuna about the difficulties that were there in controlling the mind, because it was right at that time. So this is also from the Path of Perfection. Srila Prabhupada saying, first quoting from the Bhagavad Gita 635, the Blessed Lord said, O mighty arm, son of Kunti, it is undoubtedly very difficult to curb the restless mind, but it is possible by constant practice and by detachment. Then Prabhupada says, Krishna does not say that it is not difficult. It's hard, it's difficult. Even Krishna says it is. You know, he says, in other words, yes, there's admission. This is not necessarily so easy. Don't think I'm going to just say Hare Krishna and all problems are gone. He says, no, it is difficult. Rather, he admits that it is difficult, but possible. Possible by means of constant practice. Now, what does constant practice mean? Prabhupada explains. Constant practice means engaging ourselves in some activity that reminds us of Krishna. In this society for Krishna consciousness, we therefore have many activities, kirtan, temple activities, prasad, publication, and so on. Everyone is engaged in some activity with Krishna at the center. Therefore, whether one is typing for Krishna, cooking for Krishna, chanting for Krishna, or distributing literature for Krishna, he is in the yoga system, and this is also, he is also in Krishna. So here we're seeing that there's also this importance of devotional service. So we know that Prabhupada's often said that bhakti yoga runs on two tracks, you know, the Bhagavad Gita and the Pancharatriki. So we have on one hand, we have hearing and chanting, we have the process of chanting the Hare Krishna mantra, we have our bhajan, but there's also practical service. And we know of the other, of the nine processes of devotional service, beginning with Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, then we also have Hadasevanam. We have worship, we have service. So these two things go together. Both are there, both are part of a philosophy to say which is more important. It's not really even a relevant question. Both are important. Both are given to us. And Prabhupada very expertly, when he began the Krishna conscious movement, he emphasized practical devotional service. Because, you know, especially those of us who were Westerners, we were young, we were full of energy and enthusiasm and probably in hormones and everything else, you know, full of passion, probably, to be honest, you know, knew that we need to be engaged. The mind will not be controlled unless we are working practically all the time in Krishna's service. But at the same time, it wasn't just to go out and work all the time without sadhana bhakti. So also, the hearing and chanting must be there. Otherwise, the work can become just passionate and not really be, and we can lose sight of the goal of who the service is directed to and why we're doing the service. So that's why there must be the chanting of the holy name, chanting japa 16 rounds, hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam. So both work together very nicely. And of course, now it's very difficult for most of us, but Prabhupada wanted us to do it morning and night. You know, morning and night to purify the mind, to fix the mind, become, to understand, to learn the philosophy by hearing and reading, you know, and purifying the mind through the chanting of the holy name, both in kirtan and in japa. And in between, practical devotional service. It's actually, it was such a simple and powerful process. And of course, as we can see, it's completely within what Krishna has set up. It's completely within the our Vedic understanding of how we become purified in this age of Kali. So while we must hold these two things very closely, we must have our sadhana, we must do our chanting, we also need to develop our service portfolio. We need to make sure that each one of us, that what am I doing to serve Krishna? How am I offering service every day or, you know, throughout my life? I mean, for some of you may be thinking, well, that's all I do. I'm working so many hours a day doing service. Yes, but we also see that sometimes as, you know, we get a little bit older in Krishna consciousness and we have more freedom and we have more independence, we have choice. We have choice all the time to not serve or to serve. So we have to consciously make that choice to dedicate our lives to the service of Srila Prabhupada and to Krishna and Chaitanya's movement. And that sometimes takes some conviction. It takes some determination. We have to prioritize. I mean, I don't know how many times I hear it. I say it myself. You know, I really would like to do this, but I just don't have time. Time usually means, it's usually a question of priority. I usually find that the busier I am, the more I get done. You know, I've had that experience sometimes, you know, when you have so much to do and you're so busy, but then there's one thing of service more is put on there and somehow you're able to do that. But if you're not really very busy and, you know, somehow it's almost harder to get a few things done. You know, somehow it's part of our psychology, it's part of our nature, you know, that, you know, we need to be very active, very much active and working to serve Krishna, and very consciously. One more Bhagavatam purport by Srila Prabhupada, 327.5. He says, since the senses are always active, their activity should be engaged in devotional service. One cannot stop their activities. If one wants to artificially stop the activities of the senses, his attempt will be a failure. So we have to be careful. This sometimes applies to us as we get older, or we think that we're more advanced in Krishna consciousness. We think we don't have to be so active. You know, and now some of our bodies are getting a little older and slowing down, so that activity may, you know, it may shift. It may take a different form or a different nature depending upon what we're able to do and according to our propensities and that. But we need to be very, very active in devotional service, in the nine process of devotional service, or the senses will carry us away. We will not be able to control the senses. So that means that we need to follow the principles of bhakti yoga, of sadhana bhakti. It's interesting, sometimes people think, I have gone beyond that now, or I'm more advanced, I don't need to be so careful, or, well, I'm a devotee. But it doesn't really work that way, because if we're not very careful, we can start to forget. We can forget the purpose of our service and the purpose of what we're doing. So we must, you know, keep very strong in our principles of sadhana. In fact, sometimes, you know, even the question of being on a higher platform or a more spontaneous platform, we have to remember that, you know, Raganuga Bhakti is also part of sadhana. Sadhana has two parts, Vaidhi Bhakti and Raganuga. So even one who's at the Raganuga platform, that means that they are spontaneously attracted to following the process of the devotional service. It's not a question that you stop devotional service. It's a question is that your attraction becomes, you know, just becomes more natural, more spontaneous, due to one's advancement. And of course, and we see the examples of the most exalted devotees, of the six Goswamis. What's the verse? It says that they are chanting a measured number of rounds every day. So in other words, the most elevated devotees are following the processes of devotional service, even if they don't personally need to, if you're at that high of a stage, that Paramahamsa stage, to set example for the rest that they do, to show how this is the process, particularly the chanting of the holy name for this age of Kali, that everyone can make advancement, become purified, give up all of these bad habits, and collectively we can counteract the influences of Kali Yuga. So I'll stop at that point. Any questions, comments? Krishna Keshava?
Hey Krishna. Thank you very much for tonight's class. Everything was very clear. As you were speaking about Krishna saying it's difficult, but it's possible, it reminds me of this other verse from Bhagavad Gita 18:58. If you become conscious of me, you will pass over all the obstacles of conditional life by my grace. If, however, you do not work in such consciousness, but act through false ego, not hearing me, you will be lost. I think that was a very wonderful life.
Can you expand on that a little bit for us?
Well, it just reminds me that whenever I don't hear Krishna, I can expect that I'll be lost. Yeah. And happiness a lot.
Thank you very much. Very nice verse. Did I Mahan Prabhu?
On that same point about the how you were saying that six Goswamis, they were doing these things even though they didn't have to, but what else is there to do anyway? You know, in other words, this is what they do. They derive great satisfaction and mat chitta mat pranam. I mean, that's just what they do, so it's not like there's another column, either do this or do that, but there isn't anything.
That's a great point. What are the gopis doing in Krishna Loka? They're chanting and singing the glories and the praises of Krishna, right? All the time. That's, it's our eternal position.
How about,
the different yugas. In the Satya Yuga, you could live as long as you had bones. The life force could live in the marrow of your bone.
Yeah.
In Treta Yuga, as long as you had a body. In Dwapara Yuga, as long as you had breath. In Kali Yuga, as long as there's food. But you need money for food. So, like you say, you live as long as until the money runs out. But it's true. When people don't prepare for old age, suicide is a very high rate of people 70, 80 years old that didn't save, that didn't have a temple to go to or church to get food.
Thank you. Say it once more for us. In Satya Yuga, it was the life was in the
bones?
Bones.
Hiranyakashipu could
have
bones. And also the rishis also. You might call, say, Agastya Muni. You might see him at some point in one of his austerities, and you might just see his skeleton. Maybe the demigods even thought Hiranyakashipu was dead, covered with ants. Dwapara Yuga, as long as there's a body.
As long as there's a body. Breath and the
Dwapara
body.
Dwapara Yuga, breath.
Breath.
Okay.
That's interesting. Another interesting progression of deterioration as the yugas go on. Thank you. Nartaka Gopal, Mataji?
So even though, or for some reason, the Bhagavatam points out the, you could say, sore spots in Puruva's life, but actually if you examine it, he had a very long reign and, you know, many noble deeds and great accomplishments, and actually he was, after all, from his father's side, the great-grandson of Vivasvan, you know, he was the elder brother, whose father was the elder brother of Ikshvaku, and I'm sorry, his mother, yeah. From the mother's side, from Soma, the moon god, you know, the grandson of Chandra, Soma, and great great grandson of Lord Brahma, and they say that his birth was, he was the amalgamation of the Soma and Surya Vamshas. And if you look at the genealogical table in the back of the book, you can see that even though his wife, Prabhupada said in one purport that Urvashi was actually, Prabhupada called her in a purport, a heavenly prostitute, but together they were the great-grandparents of Parashuram, you know, great-great-great-grandparents of even Lord Krishna and Balaram, of the Pandavas, Surasen, Ugrasen, I mean, so many great personalities through their children, you know, so.
Okay, so we need to cut Puruva Maharaj some slack. No more bashing of him. He's a great personality. Okay. That's a very good point. And it is a good point. These are all great personalities. They wouldn't be in the Srimad Bhagavatam if they weren't great personalities. You know, we're hearing about these glorious people. And in different ages and different times and in the different planets, there's a little bit different standards sometimes that don't necessarily apply to us.
Just one little point. I was thinking that when she may be called a prostitute, they don't say with envy. It's just the station of how her regulated or unregulated activities were, but it wasn't said with any malice. It's a different way that even though you say a name like that.
Yeah, it's true. Anything else? Okay, all glories to the Prabhupada.